guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
This is episode number 60 of Conduct Detrimental. I'm your host or co-host, Daniel Wallach, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Dan Lust. And this is opening week of the NFL regular season, but we're going to turn this week to the combat sports. But before we do so, there's some big news in the Big Ten, or maybe no news in the Big Ten. Dan, how are you? And what do we have teed up for this week?
Well, I'm good, Dan. It's been we took a little hiatus after our double episode the week prior. But in the middle, I don't think much has changed. Much of the Big Ten news is still relevant today. Of course, those who listened, we had Tom Mars on, college football attorney. And Dan and I were just talking offline. Maybe for whatever reason, we picked the right guest at the right time, our most popular episode of Conduct Detrimental. So we thank you all for sharing, and obviously whoever sharing with their friends, because we had plenty of friends that were listening. So, number one, I think it's seems to be something brewing on the Big Ten front. By the time this comes out, there might be some news. But Dan and I will talk about the legal framework behind the scenes that could be pushing the Big Ten back. We will see what's going on there. And then number two, Dan and I are going to get into the biggest news in the boxing world. Canelo Alvarez suing Oscar De La Hoya, DAZN, Golden Boy Productions, a mega $280 million lawsuit. And then last but not least, Dan and I, we didn't talk about wrestling last podcast, so we decided to devote an entire segment to some news in the wrestling world over with Vince McMahon and Titan Towers. So, Dan, I think we should start in Big Ten country. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of top of the mind, and it led to our most popular episode. So let's get that out of the way. We can certainly make, chicken salad out of chicken, given that there's been no news today. I mean, we're all waiting for the Big Ten vote. And, anyone who's reading, following these people on Twitter, like Sir Yacht, every day he's making a 100% guarantee that the Big Ten has already voted. They're going to come back on October 10th. And every 2 days, he comes out with new predictions. He's making a name for himself. But I think his batting average is certainly starting to dip below the Mendoza line. So right now, as it stands, as of the date of this recording, which is Monday night after the Giants, lose another opener, there's been no vote. So what is that going to lead to? And Dan, what do you think is really on tap for happening before we get to some of the legal issues?
So Dan, I don't want you to laugh at what I'm about to tell you, but, I might have, slid into Sir Yacht's DMs, and I might be helping him with his phrasing of his tweets from now on, because he's, tried to be straightforward with Mr. Yacht, Mr. Sir Yacht. But every tweet is phrased like a guarantee, which they're obviously not guarantees. So you could view Mr. Yacht as,
first of all, if you're sliding into his DMs, I think you've been on his podcast already.
I have been.
Congratulations. I mean,
I don't know if that's a congrats. I'm trying to, he's got a bright future ahead. I'm just trying to steer him in the right direction.
Did you get one of those yacht shirts or a Jimmy Buffett album, as a guest appearance fee for your troubles?
Not yet, Dan. Okay. But not opposed to it.
So is he somebody, based upon your observation, is he somebody who's plugged in? Does he have a source, or is he just winging it, trying to get on the radar, so to speak, on social media?
So I think I spoke to him offline. He happened to be actually local in Queens. I didn't see him in person, but we had a candid conversation. I read everything on, me, Dan. I drop into the replies. I'm reading everything. He is not batting the highest batting average, but I will say he was the first person I saw in any department that said that October 10th was a date they were circling. October 17th, he said, was a play. And then like 2-3 days later, all of the blue checkmark Twitter was saying it. So, I mean, the guy could be just taking a lot of swings, but I think this is just my opinion. I mean, I don't know the guy that well, but he seems like a bright guy. He's obviously very funny, but I don't think he's just making up out of thin air. I think he's just hearing the same little birdies chirping. And whereas other reporters might not tweet anything, he's tweeting everything and he's phrasing everything like a guarantee. So he's definitely just me. I do think he's hearing something, but he's not really media. So he's just throwing stuff at the wall and hoping it sticks. That's just
my and that seems to make sense to me, because unless he's in the room, unless he has a direct pipeline to the president or chancellor of one of these Big Ten schools, or Kevin Warren is feeding him information, he has really no basis in knowledge at all. And it seems to me that he's taking public domain information originating elsewhere and kind of, you know, adding his little guarantee flourish to it to almost make it as if it's his own. But that's neither here nor there. I mean, eventually there's going to be a vote. The vote may happen before
podcast. Our fellow Dan Patrick put out a 12-2 vote, which was not accurate. So I don't think anybody, be it, you know, your Mr. Yacht sitting on a boat, or your Dan Patrick with that great first name, or your anybody at this point, you know, I don't think anyone's is batting 1,000 in the Big Ten. So, yeah.
You can only trust us, basically. You can only trust Dan and conduct that trip.
We speak in cold, hard facts. That's what we do. Okay, so let's jump into it. Sir Yacht, I got your back, though. I got your back. I don't know about other Dan, but one of the Dans has your back. Okay, so just for people that haven't been following, Dan and I have been you know, trying to stay on top of the Big Ten news. There's been a lot, but we're going to just narrow down to the legal issues, because that's what we do as attorneys. We had Tom Mars on. We talked a lot about FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act. I spoke to Tom offline. There's a total of 26 FOIA requests that are floating out there to the 13 universities that are public in the Big Ten. The only one being the exception is Northwestern. So you can listen to the last episode if you want to hear about the FOIA requests. What Dan and I are going to talk about briefly, we're going to talk about an update in the Nebraska players lawsuit against the Big Ten Conference over in Nebraska State Court. And then number two, we're going to talk about the two different attorney generals, one from Ohio and one from Nebraska, who are, we'll say, it's kind of like the buzzards. They're kind of floating around the Big Ten. Nothing formal yet, but they're warning some stuff. So, Dan,
buzzards who need a little bit of a refresher in law school, by the way. If I'm telling you, if I had an attorney general like those two in my state, I'd be doing a recall, recall election, because they're both wrong on the law and they're both overselling it. But we'll get to that in a moment.
Dan, we control the show. So I was going
to
do the
rest. Okay, we'll get to that right now.
You're coming in hot, Dan. You're coming in hot. So a quick background, and then I'll give it to you, Dan, to just bury them as much as you can, because I know, Dan, you're trying to be the Nebraska AG. I see it in your face right now. That's got Nebraska Attorney General all over it. So the Nebraska AG, he came in with a letter, and Dan will kind of get into it. But I saw this on Friday. I was having a nice lunch with my friend, and all of a sudden this news popped across my Twitter timeline. Essentially, and I don't want to bury the lead, a letter directed directly to Kevin Warren, the Big Ten commissioner, essentially stating that the Big Ten appeared to be in noncompliance with various Nebraska state laws for, I don't want to step on your toes, but it was a warning sign shot across the bow. Dan's going to get into, obviously the punishments that were associated with that. But the reason I brought it up and the reason I think it took off on Twitter the way it did, it set forth a September 21st discovery deadline to provide additional discovery from the Big Ten related to this vote and related to the Big Ten's alleged compliance with their bylaws. So I think it was a discovery mechanism, but Dan doesn't know if there's that much teeth behind that.
Well, for those of you who do some corporate practice and do M&A work or corporate transactional work, you're very familiar. You may be familiar with the concept of having to register as an out-of-state corporation, as a foreign corporation doing business in another state. And what the Nebraska Attorney General is doing is using or trying to exploit the fact that the Big Ten does business in Nebraska by virtue of one of the member schools plays in Nebraska. And even though Nebraska has been in the Big Ten since 2011, the Nebraska AG is now raising for the first time that maybe the Big Ten is not in compliance with Nebraska corporate law, because as a foreign corporation doing business in Nebraska, you have to register with the state of Nebraska and become registered to do business as a foreign not-for-profit corporation. That is a really ministerial requirement that's common in all 50 states. And he's using that noncompliance as a lever to try to open the door to being able to look at the documents and gain greater transparency into the business affairs of the Big Ten. But the problem or the shortcoming with that kind of legal remedy is that the punishment or the consequence for failure to register when a not-for-profit is required to register is you just can't, you can't sue in the state courts. If you don't pay your registration fee and aren't registered to do business, you can't sue in Nebraska state court. That's penalty number one. The second penalty is one that's purely monetary in nature. And under the Nebraska corporate, you know, statute, the maximum penalty for failure to register as a not-for-profit, you know, foreign corporation doing business in Nebraska is an annual fine of $10,000, not to exceed $10,000. The Nebraska Attorney General is powerless to get injunctive relief or to demand anything from the from the Big Ten other than the ability to bring a civil action that could lead to fines of up to $10,000 a year. So I think this is a perfect example of the Nebraska Attorney General basically trying to score political brownie points and playing to his base, playing to the crowd, and playing to the media when there's really no legal heft behind the statute that he invokes.
So for those watching in the podcast or not watching on our YouTube feed, we should shout out to our YouTube feed if you ever want to see Dan and my expressions. I'm doing the Hulk Hogan ear thing because, listen, Mr. Doug Peterson over in Nebraska is playing to the media, and I think very effectively. So, I'd be remiss. I just want to read some of these discovery demands again. He's demanding, he filed this on Friday, September 11th, is asking for responses by September 21st, so 10 days. I'm just going to read you one of the 11 items demanded. All documents reflecting communications involving the joint group concerning the deliberative process referenced above, and all documents evidencing any recommendation made by the joint group and brought before the Council of Presidents, Chancellors as part of that deliberative process. So he's in this demand, he's essentially asking for discovery and documents pertaining to this alleged vote. Now, why that's important, I guess, I want people to keep that in mind. This is a separate mechanism that has nothing to do with what the Ohio AG is doing. It has nothing to do with what Tom Mars is doing with the FOIA request, and has nothing to do with Nebraska players' lawsuit. So I tend to think, and Dan and I were talking offline, at this point, there's a Twitter mob. Again, we're recording this on Monday, September 14th. And interestingly, and for Dan and I's purposes, it's interesting. I mean, the law is very much being used somewhat as a pitchfork to say, if you don't bring back Big Ten football, we're going to sue you. Tom Mars is going to get you. Nebraska players are going to get you. The AG is going to sue you. But I think this is more of the same. And I think it's another date that people have to be mindful of, September 21st, that will remain even if Big Ten football returns, because people still want to see this transparency. They want to know what happened with this vote. I'm not sure if people will care once the Big Ten's back. I think, Dan, you are nailing it on the head. This doesn't have that much teeth. But if it does effectively get this discovery out of the Big Ten, I think it's a small one. So
I think it's a non-starter. I mean, the Nebraska Attorney General got headlines on Friday, but I understand what he's asking for. But from a lawyer's lens, it's a joke. I mean, it really is. I mean, not failing to file a certificate of registration as a foreign corporation doing business, that's penny ante stuff, and the AG can't do anything about it if the Big Ten does not want to register to do business. Because if they register as a foreign corporation in Nebraska, then that will subject them to the prying eyes and scrutiny of the Nebraska Attorney General. By choosing to remain not registered, the worst vulnerability that they face is a small, modest monetary fine. And for a conference that generates hundreds of millions of dollars in TV revenue annually, it's basically walking around money for Kevin Warren. It's not really a big deal. And, you know, I find it amazing that lawyers, the media, will listen to these declarations and public statements made by, attorney generals, coaches, fans, players, parents, and treat it as gospel when it purely is a legal matter. It's just really inconsequential, at least the Nebraska Attorney General's threat is relatively inconsequential because, as I said, it's a very limited remedy. And, you know, it's been going on. You know, they've been in the Big Ten for 10 years and he's raising it only now for the first time. So it just strikes me as, you know, he's playing to the crowd.
So I want to just touch it quick and then we'll move to the Ohio AG. But I will agree with you, Dan. I think you and I, I agree with you on the law that there's not that much teeth to it. But I do think he's playing to the crowd. And there's a very few issues on Twitter in our country that are truly, I'll say, bipartisan issues. Obviously, there's going to be people that are on the far extremes of both sides. But if you live in Big Ten country, you can be on the left, you can be on the right. You want Big Ten football back. So I think that is what very much is being transparent. I think that's why he's doing it, because it plays to both bases. So now that I think that's a good transition to what is going on over in Ohio. So we go from one red school in the Big Ten to a different red school in the Big Ten. That is the Ohio State Buckeyes. So Dave Yost is the attorney general over here, who made headlines last week, similar to Peterson over in Nebraska. So I'm just going to this is an article from the Columbus Dispatch. So Dave Yost told the Columbus Dispatch that unless the Big Ten returns to play, that he will recommend that Ohio State University, a public university, sue for tens of millions of dollars. And I'm just going to read the quote. "I think we have a cause of action for violating contracts between the Big Ten and Ohio State and for illegal interference. If these negotiations fall apart, we will be recommending legal action." So, we've talked about Tom Mars and his FOIA request. Obviously, you and I will get into a little bit more. We talked about Nebraska players lawsuit. Now we talked about Nebraska AG. This appears, Dan, to be yet another gun pointed at the Big Ten. Call it political, call it whatever you want. This appears to seem, at least on its face, if you're talking about tens of millions of dollars, that's a couple more zeros than the 10,000 we just spoke about.
Again, this is another example of an attorney general who is using the pulpit of his office to make claims that just don't hold up under further scrutiny. I mean, I know he went to Ohio State University. Maybe he brings a little bit of a bias, to this conversation. But to bring a tortious or to threaten a tortious interference claim based upon a conference making a determination for medical or health reasons not to continue or not to move forward with a season, I think that's a very long stretch. Tortious interference, for those of us who practice, in the courts and litigate issues commercially, I mean, tortious interference is probably the most commonly asserted business tort, that exists. And anyone who's been litigating or working as a partner or associate in a law firm is very familiar with the elements, the requirements, and basically the applicable circumstances for a tortious interference claim. And I think where it falls short here is that there isn't really any affirmative action. Usually with tortious interference, you have an outsider actually interfering in some sense with an existing relationship. And what's missing here, I think, is there are several threshold requirements in order to have a viable tortious interference claim. It differs state by state somewhat. But the elements are the ones that you that are common in most states are: you need to have improper or wrongful conduct. You have to also demonstrate the absence of justification. And equally important, given the incestuous or interconnected relationship between the Big Ten and the member schools, raising a tortious interference claim by Ohio State against the Big Ten would run afoul of the well-settled principle in tortious interference law that the tortious interferer has to be a complete stranger to the business relationship.
Yeah.
You can't tortiously interfere with yourself.
So, Ohio State was in the room when this alleged tortious interference is supposedly have occurred. They subscribed to that 11-3 vote. Alleged 11-3 vote.
That's an excellent point, Dan. But Ohio State, is a member of the Big Ten Conference.
Right.
The TV, the rights deals are negotiated by the Big Ten, probably
agreed to the bylaws, right?
Yeah. So what we have are parties that are within the same, relationship zone, and the Big Ten is not sufficiently outside that relationship to be deemed a stranger to the business relationship for purposes of a tortious interference claim. So I think that a cause of action like that, or a lawsuit predicated on tortious interference with either business relations or contractual relationship or prospective economic advantage, will run smack into that wall of the affiliation, in a sense, between the Big Ten and Ohio State. And I just don't think you get by all those elements. I think the decision to cancel is not quite on the same wavelength as poaching an employee from another business. In many, you know, typical garden variety tortious interference cases, you see actual like misconduct or improper conduct. This is not so much conduct as it is a decision of to not proceed, which I think falls below the bar of what's considered improper or wrongful conduct. And when you think about the health and medical reasons for not playing, I think this is not just a 1 or 2% chance of success. I peg this as like zero. It has no legs, no legal foundation, to stand on. And I laugh when I read these press statements, and they're tweeted and reported on ad nauseum as if they have merit.
I mean, so I'm guilty of this, but Dan, I find at least again the bipartisan. We rarity on Twitter. Everyone's going to complain about something, but almost universally, right? People want college athletes to be paid. And what else do they want? They want Big Ten football back. Obviously, again, you're going to have some people, one extreme or the other, but it seems to be an issue that crosses both houses. So I bring that up. What does Dave Yost really have to lose? And again, I'm kind of speaking from my PR background. I mean, what did he really say? He goes, if the Big Ten does not return, he's going to recommend legal action to Ohio State. He hasn't really said anything, right? He's saying he's recommending it. Dan, we're not going to talk about this tonight. I know you have a lot of thoughts in it, but the Mets the sale was consummated with Steve Cohen. Laura Goldman, who I was not familiar with, who I guess she's big on these Mets message boards, but she says she's the declared queen of Mets Twitter. She had a funny tweet the other day that I had some fun with. She goes, I'm hearing A-Rod is contemplating suing the Wilpons. Mets drama may continue for a while. So she goes, I'm hearing A-Rod is contemplating suing the Wilpons. So me and my infinite hilarity, I wrote, I'm hearing A-Rod is also not contemplating suing the Wilpons. I'm told he could go either way. So the reason I bring that up, it's all really how you phrase these messages. He's recommending, if the vote doesn't pass, he's recommending this. I don't know if he's really said anything. And it's seemingly, Dan, for his base, for his political agenda, it's a win-win. Because if he's saying he's prepared to sue, he hasn't really said anything. He's not saying he's going to go forward. I'm sure he can walk it back. So I understand, why that is big, and I understand, at least in the moment of last week, why you'd want to get out there. And kind of coincidentally, I mean, maybe not coincidentally at all, people were, I mean, I've never heard of Dave Yost before. I've never heard of Doug Peterson over in Nebraska. But you don't know how many people dropped in my replies to say, I wish our AG was doing that. I wish we had this AG. And then the people within those own states, within Nebraska, within Ohio State, giving some pushback. But all of a sudden, if you get 48 states absent your own on your side, it's pretty good. I mean, people speak football. Maybe you don't speak the rest of the activities that the AG is doing in his office. But if it's your moment to get in the spotlight with something as simple as a 3-page letter, we spent the whole segment talking about Doug Peterson over in Nebraska. I mean, why not take advantage of the spotlight? When are we ever going to talk about Nebraska and conduct detrimental?
Well, and luckily for the AGs, there's no Rule 11 standard for making statements to the press. You can say whatever you want, and it will be reported, and you'll have your headline for the day. And for an elected official, that's gold. So nothing surprising. But I think as lawyers, we owe a duty and an obligation to our audience to basically call bullshit on statements like that. That really go unchecked in the media. And I'm not aggravated over that. I'm just somewhat surprised that there's not greater scrutiny placed on these outlandish statements that just people make in sports or attorney generals make. And, with most journalists not having law backgrounds, that stuff just flies over their head. When those of us in the trenches, whether we do it now or at some point in our career, understand the real challenges and the many obstacles that lie in the way of a claim like that ever succeeding. And so, well, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it's a good way to kind of segue to our last topic on this, the Big Ten front. Then we'll get over, you know, we've been talking, we're talking really about tortious interference with the contract on the Ohio AG level. And I think, I don't really think any of these lawsuits are going to happen. I don't think the AG is going to do anything. But, you know, they're just, you got to at least how I reported these. I just put them out there. People can make their own decisions, but you know, I just put it out there factually. And you know, we, in the Big Ten situation, Dan, as you and I were talking offline, there was so much misinformation. Sometimes there's a value in just providing facts. The AG said this, the Nebraska players filed this lawsuit, and then there's obviously color in there, but you know, it's important to get out facts. So now I bring up this tortious interference, Dan. I guess go with me for a second, a little bit of leeway, Your Honor. 6 days ago, Pittsburgh Steelers general manager, Kevin Colbert. He was on the NFL Ringer show, a show that I'm very fond of. I'm just going to read a quote, and this will take you to the latest in the Nebraska lawsuit. Quote, this is from, again, from the Pittsburgh Steelers GM. If there are two players that are close or equal, we'll take the one that has played most recently. We're hopeful that the other conferences get up and running. If they do, we'll add that to the evaluations. If they don't, again, all we have is 2019, and we'll make the best decisions we can. So there was a big cycle of media this time last week, and people were up in arms saying that big Ohio State players or Big Ten players should sue the conference because they're losing you know, business opportunities. And I pointed out, which you and I have spoke about on our live episode over on Instagram Live, that that's actually a claim that's currently in the Nebraska players lawsuit. This is what they referred to. They probably had two components to this, but this is tortious interference with business expectations. You and I talked about the part that was probably the moot part, the name, image, and likeness part, which is not, you know, it's not valid in the state of Nebraska right now. You can't make money off your name, image, and likeness. But in theory, you could have a tortious interference with business expectation suit if a Nebraska player was going to be, in theory, a first round pick, and now they're a fifth round pick, or they were going to be a fifth round pick, and now they're not drafted. So that's, you know, we didn't really explore that in the podcast, but now with these comments, Dan, what do you think? I think this at least gives a little bit more color to that portion of their claim.
So the Nebraska players are using, or at least claiming, the inability to play in 2020 will hamper their chances of getting drafted. And the Pittsburgh Steelers general manager's comments seem to bolster that. But I have a dirty little secret or a question that I want to pose here. Let me see if you know the answer. I'm going to give you this question. Let's see if you can pass it. In the 2019 NFL draft, how many Nebraska players were drafted?
The way you're asking it makes me think the answer is zero, Dan.
Yes. Yes. Bingo. Zero.
A poker player over here. I knew it.
2020. I think two players were drafted, and I'm not saying that, the theory has no, you know, plausible basis, but it does underscore an important element that has to be proven to establish damages and causation. You're going to have to get around the speculativeness, you know, argument or counter argument that would be raised by the Big Ten hypothetically. I mean, my torts professor in law school, the late Larry Kessler, the late Professor Lawrence Kessler, who taught torts to me in 1L 1988, came up or delivered this expression in class, and I never forgot it. The expression is, many are called, few are chosen, right? So what that basically means is that playing college football is no guarantee of anything. You could be the best player in Nebraska and still not get drafted, as 2019 or 2019 establishes. And simply because the games aren't being played this year, maybe it impacts draft position. Maybe you go around lower, or maybe become an undrafted free agent. But the road to the NFL is not blocked simply because the games are not being played. But really, the bottom line is that it is, in my view, too speculative to base a tortious interference theory on the cancellation of the season being the cause in fact, or the proximate cause of you not making the National Football League. That's a huge stretch legally. I understand the present sense appeal of it sounds, you know, logical, But under a legal analysis, you know, the speculativeness or the speculative characteristics of that kind of theory, I think, make it unsuitable to be recoverable damages or proximate causation.
I have a quiz for you, Mr. Wallach. You ready for this?
Yes.
Who, it's a two-part question. Who was the last Nebraska Cornhusker to win the Heisman Trophy?
I'm going to go with Johnny Rogers, 1971-72.
Incorrect. It is Mr. Eric Crouch was one of the first years I got really into college football. He was a kind of a option running quarterback, ended up playing wide receiver in the pros, but that was 2001. Dan, and here's the second part of the question. Over under a fourth round pick, was he above a fourth round pick or after the fourth round?
Probably after the fourth round. Nope.
Third round pick. But he might as well have been not drafted because not the most successful playing career. No hate on Eric Crouch. I was a big fan with the Cornhuskers, but he ended up being a wide receiver in pros. But
neither well, he's no Dean Steinkuehler. Do you know who Dean Steinkuehler is?
And I didn't know who Johnny Rogers was either. So I'm 0-2 on knowing those players.
Dean Steinkuehler was a stud offensive lineman for the Nebraska Cornhuskers on the 1983 team. That lost, I believe, to Howard Schnellenberger's University of Miami. And he was drafted, I believe, one slot before the Giants drafted Carl Banks.
What number was Carl Banks, Jan? What jersey number?
58. We're two episodes past that already. You got to stay with the program. But the issue, or I think the interesting fact that this underscores is we're talking about the University of Nebraska in 1970, 1980. The reality is that the program isn't at the same level today as it was in its heyday when Tom Osborne was running the program, because I could make the same analogy to City College of New York and New York University. They had they were perennial NCAA or NIT title teams in the late 1940s, early 1950s before the college basketball scandal. And I think they have yet to produce an NBA player since that scandal. So, again, we could quibble about relative strengths of the program, but making the National Football League, it's a long haul. A lot has to go right. You have to be drafted or signed by the right team. And I don't accept the premise that the cancellation of the season is the reason why these eight plaintiffs aren't going to make the NFL or will earn substantially less in the NFL. It's too speculative.
So just to kind of wrap up where we are with the Big Ten, and I anticipate by the time most of the listeners to this will have an update, and then Dan and I'll move to the next one. But, you know, the eight Nebraska players have sued. They're still, as of today, my understanding is that the Big Ten did provide the discovery to the Nebraska players, to Mike Flood, the attorney over there. That has not been publicized. Dan and I have we spoke offline that might be some confidentiality order in place. There had been a deadline to file for the Big Ten to file a motion to dismiss. Dan and I, we haven't seen a stipulation to extend. So at least we believe they might have blown that deadline. Don't read too much into it because it looks like they're on the verge of some vote. But yeah, I mean, Dan, the reason we bring all of these up, I think for better, for worse, Dan, these statements in the media, these lawsuits, these threatened lawsuits, I think they did force the Big Ten back to the table for this vote. And we'll see what happens for the vote. We'll see if they get the nine votes to muster. But I do think that this was part of the public pressure as well as the parents' protest that it did get them back to the table. What do you think before we move on?
Well, I think we may be back to square one, depending on how the vote comes out. They may vote to, you know, maintain the status quo. Or you could have a split situation where some teams play, some teams don't play. I don't think we've heard the last of these legal controversies, but I am very thankful for what this Big Ten battle or saga has yielded for us. There are an endless list of legal issues and so many nuanced issues that really highlight the need for the kind of expertise that you and I try to provide on a weekly basis. It looks at, you know, what's going on between the lines or in the big game or the big legal story, the big sports stories, but looks at it through the legal end, through the legal lens. I can't talk this late at night. I'm sorry. But almost every story that you're seeing on the ESPN ticker, if you look at the headlines, a majority of them have some business and or legal component to them, and those issues are not easily understood by the mainstream press. So what's going on with the Big Ten today plays right into our wheelhouse, and hopefully you know, our audience will benefit from it. And I think it helps sharpen our own skills because we go to school on some of these issues to try to get a better understanding of it prior to going on the podcast. And it's really fascinating to me. I mean, just it's almost like being in law practice to, you know, try to, you know, solve these puzzles.
Yeah. So I think that's we'll put a pin in that. We'll move on to our final two topics, and we'll keep these much shorter, but we do want to hit on this. We can't talk about Big Ten football on every podcast. So that'll take us to our second topic. If you are a boxing fan, this is, I'm told, the biggest story in the past couple of years in boxing, let alone the intersection between boxing and the law, which is there's not that much overlap. Dan and I haven't talked about that yet.
Oh, so. There is. Au contraire, Dan. Boxing litigation is its own subspecialty because you have no oversight body, no regulatory. We have all these alphabet groups, boxers suing promoters suing boxers, managers suing promoters. It is an endless, you know, march in the court system. And, you know, my old boss, Jay Goldberg, used to say there are no new cases, just new faces. And you could, and he must have been talking about the boxing business.
Well,
and,
I guess
and the court system.
I'll correct my prior statement. We'll say no boxing legal stories that come across that ticker that we've spoke about. That is more rare. Maybe you have different lawsuits. So just a quick background to Canelo Alvarez. You know, he's one of the best, we'll say, pound for pound fighters in the world. People will have heard of this, we'll say, the streaming platform called DAZN. A guy by the name of John Skipper, formerly with ESPN. He's been behind the magic over there. I listened to him probably a year ago at this point do a podcast with Bill Simmons. And he talked about DAZN's got a big pocket. They're going to try to buy up all these different boxing events. They're going to take over the sports world one sport at a time. So their first foray was boxing. And that was after HBO Sports went down. And their first really big get was Canelo Alvarez, one of the top boxers in the world. You know, he's in his early 30s. He's really in the prime, still in the very much the prime of his career. Back in late 2018, he signed an exclusive deal with DAZN, that is spelled out D-A-Z-N, if people don't know what DAZN is. And essentially, it was a 11-fight deal. It was going to be $350 million to be paid out. It was right around there. I think it was in the vicinity of between $35 million and that vicinity for each fight. Now, there is some discrepancy as to who had final approval over which fight and if it was going to be DAZN's call. And also, we should note that Canelo Alvarez, his direct deal was with Golden Boys Production, which is Oscar De La Hoya's company. He serves as the CEO. So they're all involved in this. And just for factual purposes, Canelo Alvarez had three fights under the DAZN label. A guy by the name of Gennady Golovkin, you'll know him as Triple G. He was signed to this DAZN label in early 2019. So those two had fought twice. The initial intention, per reports from Dan's colleagues over at The Athletic, was that the whole purpose of this DAZN deal to sign Triple G, you know, a couple months after signing Canelo Alvarez, was to have this trilogy fight at some point in 2019. Now, Dan, we're ending we've gone past 2019, now we're nearing the end of 2020. There is no Gennady Golovkin, Canelo Alvarez fight on the radar. And I think that is painting a lot of these conversations. So, Dan, I will turn it over to you. We have a $280 million breach of contract suit filed by Canelo Alvarez against Oscar De La Hoya personally, against Golden Boys Productions, against DAZN. He's really named a ton of players in here. Dan, you know, what do you think about the lawsuit? And what do you think about the lawsuit getting kicked out within a couple hours of it being filed?
Yeah, it's actually a former lawsuit as we speak. On Friday, September 11th, a day that lives in our country's, you know, history forever, on that day, the judge overseeing the federal court case in the Central District of California in Los Angeles entered an order sua sponte. Now, sua sponte means the judge didn't
call
wait
me
for...
Dan.
Yeah. Dan, do you know what sua sponte means?
Yes, Mr. Wallach, Professor Wallach, I apologize. It means that the judge decided to do something on his own without somebody asking him to do it.
Yeah, and because the judge, in this case, you win and you get the A-plus answer. And we didn't discuss this beforehand, so you earn that on merit.
I know a thing or two.
Yeah, what I've seen quite a bit in federal court practice is when a complaint on its face fails to properly allege the jurisdictional minimums, the jurisdictional requirements like diversity of citizenship. You've got to allege the citizenship of the different parties and make sure the plaintiffs are completely diverse from all the defendants. And what I mean by diversity is your citizenship, state of incorporation, place where you live. In this case, Alvarez's attorneys made an error. They alleged that two of the limited liability company defendants, there was a DAZN USA LLC entity and a Golden Boy Promotions LLC entity. There were multiple corporate entities that were sued for both Golden Boy and DAZN, and LLC was among the sued defendants. But for LLCs, you can't just simply allege where they are incorporated, where they're registered, or where their principal places of business are. In federal court practice, for diversity purposes, the citizenship of a limited liability company is determined by the citizenship of the individual members who comprise the LLC. And what the complaint failed to do here was identify or list the citizenships or residencies of the different LLC members. And the complaint got kicked out without prejudice, and Canelo Alvarez's attorneys were given until September 28th to cure that defect and to properly allege diversity of citizenship. So again, it's temporary, you know, roadblock or a little minor bump on the road to judgment, because inevitably they will either cure this defect by dropping the limited liability company defendants or by listing the residence or the citizenship of the individual members. But it begs the question, how do you find out who the members of an LLC are? That isn't necessarily public information. When you go to a state attorney general or Department of Business Regulation and you look up companies, you don't necessarily see all the shareholders or the LLC members. So Dan, is there a way of ascertaining that?
For those in podcast world, I was raising my hand and I wasn't called on because I had a really good answer. Dan, this could be an emergency discovery proceeding, just like we saw in the Nebraska action. I had one over in, I think it was Queens Supreme Court, but somebody sued us pre-suit. They just, I'll give you the brief facts for those that don't care about sports. They just sign up for the law. Someone wanted to know the actors of a particular, we had an accident over at a recreation park. And they wanted to know the different staff members that were on site because they wanted to include them personally named in the lawsuit for whatever reason. So we got hit with pre-suit discovery to figure out the names of potential witnesses, and they wanted to see different documents. And so they were trying to figure out the necessary parties involved. So sometimes you got to deal with that in the law. So, that's what you could do. And Dan, I'd be remiss. You know, there really are two ways this lawsuit could go from this point. A, they could just refile, which might be the route. I guess they could do emergency discovery if they want to listen to our podcast. Shout out to Canelo Alvarez's attorneys if you are listening. But the other route, Dan, is the one that Oscar De La Hoya, who was a named defendant in the lawsuit individually. And I should mention, if you were named an individual individually in a lawsuit, there could be a couple reasons. One of them, Dan and I were talking offline. One of them could be because there's an accusation of fraud, as there is here, in which you would allege that you would be piercing the corporate veil and you'd have to go after them personally. Mm-hmm. Dan, I'll let you speak to the other one. But, De La Hoya on his Twitter feed, he's got a million followers. I don't know if he posts that much, but he's Oscar De La Hoya. So, we got to check his feed for stories like this. This is from him. This is on Saturday. While yesterday's order does not end the case, we are hopeful that this error will allow us to reset and we focus on what's important, working together to get Canelo back in the ring against the top opponent, ASAP. If not, we expect Canelo's lawyers will now enter arbitration as is laid out in our contract. So Dan and I spoke offline. We have not seen the contract, but it's not something that is public that we've seen. But what Oscar De La Hoya is saying, as most big contracts would have, is that there is a necessary and compulsory arbitration clause. So that might be the next route, Dan, if they don't want to take the route that you laid out on Twitter, taking a temporary restraining order, seeking injunctive relief. Mm-hmm. Maybe just go to arbitration and you fast track this.
Well, two thoughts on that. I thought it was notable that Alvarez's attorneys did not include a copy of the agreement between Alvarez and Golden Boy as an exhibit to the complaint. Generally, when you file a breach of contract lawsuit, your complaint not only has to specify which provisions of the agreement were breached, but normally, at least it's required in state court in a number of different states. In Florida, you have to attach the contract. And what the failure to attach the contract here tells me, or at least gives me some really strong indication, that there's probably some language in the contract that's not really all that helpful, Canelo Alvarez. And I would think the arbitration clause would be front and center, because if there was a mandatory arbitration provision that really was airtight, he wouldn't be able to move forward with this lawsuit. The judge would either dismiss it sua sponte or compel arbitration, or the parties would file, Golden Boy would file a motion to dismiss or motion to compel arbitration. But the fact that there's an arbitration clause between Golden Boy and Alvarez does not preclude Alvarez from suing DAZN in the court system, because as many of you who are lawyers and studying law, non-signatories to an arbitration agreement are not bound by that arbitration agreement. There are exceptions, and certainly when the overall relationship is integrated, where there's an arbitration clause in the deal between DAZN and Golden Boy and an arbitration clause in the deal between Golden Boy and Alvarez, maybe that presents a stronger case for arbitration of the entire controversy. But I just don't think that that Alvarez, as a non-signatory, is bound to arbitrate his dispute with DAZN. And let's not make any mistake about it. The real heart of the controversy here is DAZN's repudiation, or at least backing away from its contractual commitment to pay a $40 million license fee, to Golden Boy Promotions. It's DAZN's failure to live up, or alleged failure to live up to, its contractual commitments that are at the heart of this agreement. And I think this case is really the first major COVID-19 lawsuit. And in many ways, DAZN is following Under Armour's blueprint for trying to disavow its contractual commitments in the COVID-19 era, because the contract to pay Canelo 11 fight deal, 300 or 400 million, whatever the amount is, it's probably not quite as valuable in a COVID-19 environment when you don't have a live gate, and maybe there's less interest in boxing. Who knows? But they're in a precarious position as a company. They're trying to go public. They're looking for new equity investors. They're furloughing employees. Their subscriptions have been down, and they've been making efforts to avoid paying rights fees on some of these canceled games. So their position as a company is dramatically different than it was in 2018 when they needed this deal.
Yeah, I guess a couple things. The one I'd be remiss if we didn't forget, Oscar De La Hoya is included in the caption, number one, because I mentioned for fraud, and Dana and I spoke up on it. There's an allegation that Oscar De La Hoya was a personal signatory on this guarantor on the actual contract.
That will get you sued.
Yeah. Either way, you'll get in there one way or the other. So I think the other part of this, if you're just kind of reading between the lines, and Dan kind of alluded to it, in Golden Boy's unofficial response when they spoke to the media while the lawsuit was still active, for that brief window, they did say that under the contract, which Dan and I haven't seen, that there is essentially no affirmative obligation by Golden Boys to have any events sans fans. It's completely optional. They have no obligation to do so. So that would probably be their immediate defense, that they couldn't have breached the contract in that sense, because they didn't have an obligation to fight. But I think the second one, which we have to kind of watch too, Golden Boy also signaled that they also have say over who the fighter can be in any given context. And I think if we're just trying to speculate here, as lawyers do, sometimes we have to kind of look for those type of answers. I think there is a world in that this lawsuit was filed, a $280 million, on a slow Tuesday, to try to get people talking about Canelo Alvarez again, because the man has not fought, I believe, in over a year. We haven't seen him in a boxing ring in a while. So he's now back in the public conscience, for better or for worse. I didn't see Free Canelo Alvarez trending, which might have been his intention from this.
Well, I mean, boxing has changed a lot since the 1970s, 1980s, when fighters like Mike Tyson would fight somebody every month. Canelo Alvarez has been on a 2-fight-per-year schedule since 2015. And guess how many fights he's had in 2020? He's had zero. I mean, COVID-19 is playing a significant role in that, but boxing associations and matches in both UFC and outside of the UFC have made accommodations for either playing in a bubble, playing on a side, having the event staged without fans, and in this over the top streaming era that we're in, the live gate really isn't as significant as it used to be. The majority of the revenues come from pay-per-view and broadcasting and streaming. And it doesn't seem logical or plausible that boxing matches would not be able to move forward when you have combat sports, conducting their cards, and all the major sports back except for the Big Ten. So I think there's a way, if DAZN or De La Hoya are trying to stand on a force majeure clause, first of all, we haven't seen the clause yet, but I don't think the scheduling of a bout would be reasonably beyond the control of the parties or whether the pandemic places the scheduling of about beyond their control, because you could still stage a match, sell pay-per-view, and generate probably like 90% of what you would be able to do without a live gate. So I understand Canelo's dilemma, because he hasn't fought this year. And as a 30-year-old fighter, the window is certainly closing at some point on his career. And this 11-fight deal is supposed to cover 4 or 5 years until 2023. And he's only 3 fights into an 11-fight deal, and he's been inactive this year. So what that suggests to me is that if this lawsuit doesn't prompt a reaction or some negotiation towards a solution or resolution, we could be seeing, emergency injunction, preliminary injunction, motion practice very soon, because lawsuits take a long time to play out. Summary judgment, discovery, trial, appeals. I think that Canelo either needs to move for TRO or just sign a deal with another promoter for a one fight contract, after giving a deadline for DAZN and De La Hoya to try to make good on the contractual commitments. And if they don't do so, he should be able to move forward with another promoter without being in breach of his existing deal, and let De La Hoya and DAZN try to preliminarily enjoin him, because one of the elements that will definitely not be able to be satisfied here is any irreparable harm to Golden Boy or to DAZN. And an athlete with a limited time in which to ply his trade basically faces the ruination of his career if he goes any extensive length of time without being active.
So, obviously Dan and I will continue to monitor that and stay tuned to our social media feeds for updates on that one. Okay. And last but not least, Dan, we'll bring us home with our third topic. Try to keep this one pretty tight, but obviously if we can get a wrestling topic in there, we will do it. So Vince McMahon, about a week or two ago at this point, sent out a letter to WWE performers. There was a heated phone call on a random Sunday night that the product needs to be rejuvenated. And then a couple days later, McMahon, some wondered why, sent out an interesting letter that performers needed to no longer be involved with outside third parties. So I'm just going to read you a quote from this letter. Some of you are engaged with outside third parties using your name and likeness in ways that are detrimental to our company. It is imperative that these activities be terminated within the next 30 days, parentheses, by October 2nd. Continued violations will result in fines, suspensions, or termination at WWE's discretion. So if you're wondering what I'm saying or what McMahon's saying by outside third parties, that includes Twitch, it includes Cameo, and it includes even something like TikTok. Now we can get into, and Dan, if you want to ask me, I probably know the wrestling reasons behind that, but let's first talk about the legal ramifications behind that. Do you think McMahon has any ground to stand on with this this ban of third-party platforms?
He can do whatever he wants. I mean, he owns, he's the majority owner, principal owner of a of a major company that has significant bargaining leverage and economic disparity that greatly favors the WWE in its contractual and business relations with their quote unquote independent contractors. If you don't like it, you're free to take your wrestling tights and go somewhere else. Unfortunately, there isn't a somewhere else that has the same cachet as the WWE. So he can do whatever
AEW
he wants.
AEW is getting there. We're getting close. Keep going.
The real issue, and I understand that his principal argument is that the WWE invests significant resources in creating these storylines, developing the characters. I mean, Roman Reigns, that's a character and a storyline that's the WWE's intellectual property. It does not belong to the individual who plays Roman Reigns. So on one level, he has a really strong economic proprietary interest in preserving and protecting his intellectual property rights. But he runs a real risk here of jeopardizing the relationship between the WWE and their wrestlers, which historically has been categorized as one of being an independent contractor status. These wrestlers have long tried to argue that they're employees. They've sued the WWE unsuccessfully over concussion related issues and employment related issues, and have strenuously argued that they're employees. But court after court after court has resisted that argument and found them to be independent contractors. So how this plays into the latest news is that the courts have devised all these different tests for what constitutes an employee versus an independent contractor. There's a lot of case law out there on it. And the prime quality or the major factor or criterion of an employee is the right to control their activities. And what Vince McMahon is doing here is adding a layer of control over what these employees are capable of, or what these independent contractors can or cannot do with respect to their activities outside of the WWE. And the more that McMahon imposes requirements like that on his wrestlers, it begins to shift, or at least go down the continuum from independent contractor to employee, and that could have significant legal repercussions for the company that don't otherwise exist today.
So I think I want to give McMahon all the credit in the world that this, he's taking advantage of his platform. But I will say, Dan, on a wrestling level, because I'm 32 years young. I grew up in the Attitude Era. I dabble in the. My wife watches Real Housewives. I don't think a little AEW, a little Monday Night Raw hurts anybody.
Who's your favorite wrestler?
I'm a pretty diehard Chris Jericho fan. I've followed him for a number of years.
Ask me in the history of wrestling, who's the best that you've ever seen on the mic, on the in-camera, on the interviews, between matches?
Dan, do you know what the name of this podcast is? It doesn't matter what the name of this podcast is, because it would be The Rock. Tell by your face, you didn't. I'm not insulting.
No way. The Rock was masterful.
False.
But I don't know what you're about to say. Macho Man Randy Savage, first ballot Hall of Famer on the stick.
I think nobody did
it better.
You know, I love Macho Man, but we'll say The Rock is a little more pure. But anyway, the reason I bring it up, McMahon, as Dan has laid it out, has a lot of control over these wrestlers. But just with the new way that social media is trending, there is a wrestler that recently went to AEW. He got fired from WWE, went to AEW. A guy, you'll know him. Some people know him by this name, Rusev. He's changed his name to this guy named Miro. So what wrestlers had been doing, and it makes sense under the brand, you'd build up a following on be it Twitter, Instagram, or Twitch. And then when you left the company, more often than not, you would get to keep your own social media. Sometimes you'd lose it. Sometimes you'd have to start from scratch. And, sometimes to Dan's point, they'd have your name. So you couldn't go ahead and use it. You'd have to start over. So, this guy who's now very big in AEW, basically used his WWE platform to build up his Twitch account. That's the video game streaming platform. And then he used that to kind of leverage a new deal with this company, AEW. So now there's, at least from my vantage point, there seems to be a lane for wrestlers to, change their career path or maybe build a platform that the WWE has no control over. One of the WWE's main stars, a guy by the name of AJ Styles, announced that he was diagnosed with COVID-19 on Twitch, completely off of a WWE-controlled network. So when McMahon is saying, and we probably should have shouted out the podcast, you know, that there is conduct, he didn't say exactly, but he says, you know, using your name and likeness in ways that are detrimental to our company. I don't know exactly what he means by that, but if people are making big announcements and there's a lot of eyeballs attracted to a certain platform that's not controlled by WWE, maybe that is viewed as detrimental. So I think this is another mechanism of control. I think it's McMahon trying to get a stranglehold on influencers and trying to make money in a way that is not traditional at WWE control. So the question is, legally, can he pull it off? I mean, it sounds like he's going to get away with it.
Well, he has been getting away with it his entire career. I mean, every lawsuit involving the WWE is filed in the District of Connecticut federal court. And if you were to take a look on Westlaw as to the outcome of those cases, the WWE is basically undefeated in the District of Connecticut. It has,
like Goldberg once upon a time, but keep going.
Right. But everybody loses, even Bruno Sammartino, the Hulk, but in the court of law, the WWE
not when he's angry. The Hulk doesn't lose when he's angry.
You know, but in the judicial system, the WWE has won time and time again in front of these federal courts in Connecticut. And I think McMahon's emboldened. First of all, his personality, his attitude, and you know, they're backed by, you know, just a significant legal team. I mean, they just pummel people in federal court cases. So I think he feels that no matter what he does, he's going to win in the end and the courts will uphold any decisions that he makes. But certainly as he begins to exert more control over what these wrestlers do in their free time or what they don't do in their free time, it begins to look more and more like an employer-employee relationship. And that's something that the WWE has fought for years. But a decision like this or an action like this really could begin to chip away at that wall between independent contractor and employee.
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting one. This is not one that Dan and I are probably going to hear that much about because there's not much attention being paid behind the scenes. And normally, as we've seen in the history of wrestling or maybe even any company, if you speak up against a particular policy, they might show you the door. So I don't think we're going to hear any wrestlers push back on that. But as always, you know you'll hear it from us if we do. So Dan, I think that puts us in the books for this episode of Conduct Detrimental. You have anything to add before we officially close the door?
Yeah, we have an appearance together this week. I just saw a tweet from you earlier today. So let's stand-up comedians, let's plug our future appearances. We're both going to be a panelist at a virtual law school event for Florida Coastal School of Law, Sports Law in 2020, featuring you, me, Justin Sievert, and a number of other sports lawyers that we all know. And you don't need to be a student. You don't have to be a law student. You don't have to be a lawyer. You just need to register or sign up for this. It's a free event, and we'll take what we do here on Conduct Detrimental and amplify some of these issues even further. Running probably the Big Ten will be a big highlight. Maybe Zion Williamson will touch upon some of these issues, but it's a freebie. And if you have an interest, just check out Dan's Twitter feed or my Twitter feed. We'll promote it, and we have been promoting it, but it's this Thursday, September 17th at 6 p.m. Eastern. And most importantly, it's open to all and it's free.
I think one more shout out before we close it up. A quick shout out to Mike Lawson, who edits our podcast and runs the some of our social media platforms, and Taryn Sharma, who runs our YouTube account. Those two were both very instrumental in the success of our last episode. The biggest in the Dan L and Dan W era. Maybe not the biggest in the Dan W era, but at least the biggest in the new era. So Dan, with that being said, as always, Dan Wallach is over on Twitter and Instagram at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust, at Sports Law Lust, the show, Conduct Detrimental at Con Detrimental. As always, it does help to leave a review, phone a friend, phone a wrestler, and we will see you next week on another episode. Dan, you do it. I like when you do it.
See you next time on Conduct Detrimental, episode 61. Have a great week, everybody, and see you next time.